prosecutor.
I apologize to all, but I'm confused, and I would appreciate help from any of you. So let me start off with my famous fictitious firm of Dewey, Cheatham & Howe. And let's make it a U.S. Firm that's registered. And let's also have another firm that's in a different country that we'll call Howe Indeed. Initially, let's assume that these firms are not in a network, but that Howe Indeed performs an audit for a company, and it is registered with PCAOB. And so it gets no reliance on any U.S. firm and does its audit. Conversely, let's take Dewey, Cheatham & Howe. It has a multinational client, and in some fashion contracts with Howe Indeed for services to be performed in its audit. In those situations, it seems relatively clear to me that we know currently how to handle any quality control issues with respect to those two audits. What I don't understand is two points. If we now create those two firms as a network, do we have some different expectation with respect to quality controls that would exceed the quality controls that we would have expected if they were not networked? And two, do investors perceive that there would be a difference in the quality of the audit somehow if Howe Indeed could use the name of Dewey, Cheatham & Howe in its audit report? So that's the question. Any one of you are welcome to ignore me or answer as you choose.
Oh, I'd be happy to make a couple of observations that might be helpful. First of all, it's my understanding that, and maybe SEC staff, if I have this wrong, can correct me, but Howie wouldn't have to employ Dewey Cheatham in order to be a PCAOB registered firm and sign the financial statements of that FPI. Appendix K would say that you have to have a review on the engagement level by somebody that was knowledgeable of U.S. GAAP and GAS. And when you don't have a network and that provides a natural place create that type of situation, you can go to the office of the chief accountant and talk about what your capabilities are and get signature. Along those lines, your question of, well, if suddenly Howie becomes part of Dewey Cheaty or Dewey Cheatham, is there a different expectation, et cetera? A lot of things are based on perspective in life, but certainly once you have a global network that is aiding in a filing review program, I think that's a different perspective than somebody that is a foreign-based accounting firm signing off on U.S. GAAP who doesn't have anybody, doesn't have a network affiliate in the U.S.
Jack, if I can just follow up, what you're saying is you would expect that U.S. firm to be held to a higher level because of its foreign affiliate, even though the foreign affiliate is conducting the audit.
I did not intend to make that impression that the U.S. firm would be held to a higher level. I think there is, when you're talking about the network in totality, I think there's probably a perception of a higher level.
Would any of the other panelists like to comment?
I'll just make an observation. I'd have to leave it to the investor representatives in terms of the perception part of the question, but and this is maybe is grounded too much in what might be common sense, but maybe you'll decide it's not such common sense. But the way I would look at it is if you had two firms that are independent of one another, but one firm was engaging the other, and actually that's generally not the way the process works. It's usually if two firms are independent of one another and one is going to rely on the other, the two firms are engaged by their respective clients, and then there are professional standards on how one firm is able to rely on the other. But in that, any way you structure that, what you have is two independent firms, presumably with different policies, procedures, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess the common thread that the principal auditor would be looking to would be professional standards in terms of what to expect from the other firm. And contrast that to two firms that's in an association with one another where there is agreement not only to use a common name or the right to use a common name, but also having common policies and procedures, quality control policies, common inspection programs, backed up with remediation and discipline. My common sense would say that the association would be a superior situation versus the two independent firms, and that has nothing to do with U.S. firm or anything else. It just, as I said, is kind of a common sense thing.
Yeah, I would just make an observation from my past life and past experiences that I don't think there are too many situations where you have an unaffiliated standalone accounting firm signing a audit opinion at FPIs. I remember that question a couple of times, but Lynn's looking at me like he thinks there's more.
Jerry? Hello?
You go ahead, Damon.
Yeah, guys, that one, get on the line, am I? Mike, the speaker just spoke mentioned who signed the audit opinion, and that's what I want to make sure I understand clearly. It seems like this is relevant to two different situations. One, the foreign private issuer; the other is potentially the auditing of foreign subsidiaries, affiliates of U.S. U.S. public companies. Am I right in drawing my own experience that generally in the U.S., that for each of your networks, that in the case of the U.S. public company with the foreign affiliates, that the audit opinion is signed by the U.S. firm, and that that the U.S. firm may in certain respects be relying on the work of network members, but the audit opinion expressed is the opinion of the U.S. firm. And then tell me, what is the situation typically with the foreign private issuer? What legal entity signs?
Jack?
I'll go ahead. I'm familiar with those rules. A foreign private issuer would be, the audit opinion would be signed by the auditor of record, which typically would be an audit firm in the same country as the group headquarters of the FPI that, in fact, has registered. If it's a French company, it will be signed by a French firm. In contrast, a domestic registrant, the group financial statements or the consolidated financial statements, would be signed typically by a U.S. firm. There are a handful of issues on the margin because a foreign-based company can become a U.S. domestic registrant if it fails certain criteria, and then there is a protocol and analysis and guidance that one goes through to determine who is eligible to be the auditor of record for that for purposes of SEC registrants, but those are pretty few and far between us.
I'm not sure that I understood that if that subsidiary, I don't know if it was Dewey and Cheatham or Cheatham and Howe, if they were a significant subsidiary, I think you have a principal auditor issue, I think, first off. So I wasn't really sure if I quite understood where we were there. But assuming that they're not significant, I think we would have a problem in our model. Now, once again, I think our model differs to some extent, but or even to a great extent. But we do have difficulty accepting the work, certainly of a non-affiliated firm. I don't think that we would get beyond the acceptance procedures in our U.S. firms. So I think you'd have to evaluate that. If it was an affiliated firm, we'd certainly go through our policies and procedures to make their work our own. As many times you'll have the foreign affiliated firms will be issuing statutory accounts in their local jurisdiction. So audits have been done. They may have been done under a foreign basis of accounting, but we're able to then work with that firm to make their work our own, which means working together with them from the beginning of the audit right through the filing of the foreign private issuer's financial statements.
Excuse me, just a minute, Damon. Could you mute your phone? Just do you have another follow-up?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, thank you. Any other panelists have any additional comments?
Excuse me. Under your model, you say you do not rely on the members of your network, and you perform as a principal auditor all of the required steps. I guess my question is, what's the benefits of having a global audit network then?
Well, I think when we say we don't rely, it doesn't mean that we don't work together with our foreign affiliated firms. I think you might be extending it then that we would send our own audit teams to do all the work from soup to nuts, let's say. And that's not the case. Like I said, we work together with our firms from the acceptance, planning, and right through the supervision, review, and issuance stages. So there are benefits, certainly. There are cultural differences as well. So you need to get over those hurdles also. And like I said before, most of these clients are typically clients of the foreign affiliated firm. So there are relationships and ongoing history of audits and local audits and statutory reporting that may have pre-existed our involvement.
Arnie Hanisch.
Yeah, I was curious. We try to determine that our financial people are qualified to do their job. I was curious as to what specifically you all do to try to verify or determine that the people working on U.S. registrants are actually qualified in U.S. GAAP. My personal experience is that many of them are certainly well qualified in the local statutory aspects of their accounting. That's the way they've been trained in their local universities. But do you have some sort of a training program or qualification program that you put the staff people through that are going to be working on the engagements of U.S. multinational companies to somehow ensure that they are validated, that they are qualified in U.S. GAAP, to understand when they're auditing that they can even identify an issue?
I'll take that one first. We do not currently have an accreditation program globally. We do the U.S. engagement team and the U.S. gatekeeper would look at the training and qualifications of the proposed members of the engagement team and the other member firm. If that foreign subsidiary is a significant subsidiary of the group, the U.S. engagement team would actually dispatch U.S. personnel to play a key role in the oversight of the conduct, planning and the conduct of the audit in that foreign jurisdiction. But we don't have an accreditation program at this time.
At Deloitte, we have a program process. I call it accreditation or whatever name one would want to give it, that does call for, through training and experience, personnel, and I think I mentioned this in my remarks, personnel in firms outside of the U.S. Member firm and other member firms, be it recognized as qualified to work on subsidiaries, audits, work for U.S. registrants. That, you know, the degree to which that is required depends upon the size of the subsidiary, the nature of their operations, and so forth, in relation to the consolidated entity. But that by no means is all that's done. I've mentioned a couple times that depending on the size, the complexity of the overseas operation, the lead engagement partner and others from the U.S. engagement team would visit those locations periodically to become familiar with the engagement team members. And in certain situations, we actually have U.S. people seconded to other member firms to work with engagement teams in those firms. So there are several ways that our engagement partners approach that situation.
At Ernst & Young, we have minimum standards of education and experience for key personnel, both for our two globally supported GAPs, both U.S. GAP and IFRS, and we have protocols on how to deal with situations where we may have somebody in a key position assigned to an engagement that, in fact, might not have as much experience as we like and how to deal with that. We also, in our multi-location guidance, establish protocols for partners in important situations to make visits and evaluations.
Jeff Mahoney.
Last year, in connection with the SEC's proposal to eliminate the U.S. GAAP IFRS reconciliation requirement, a comment letter from one of the accounting investor groups on that proposal pointed out that one of the many benefits of the U.S. GAAP IFRS reconciliation is that at least some of the Big Four firms had special procedures in place with respect to the reconciliation, where they had U.S. GAAP and IFRS experts focusing on that reconciliation. And it was my understanding that those reviews, those internal reviews related to reconciliation, had a real positive effect in finding a lot of IFRS application problems before those financial statements were ever issued. As we all know, the SEC has gone ahead and eliminated the reconciliation requirement. So my question is, now that we've lost that review process that many viewed as very important in catching problems with IFRS implementation, have new procedures been put in place to replace what we've lost?
I'll take a stab at that one. As I mentioned in my remarks earlier, the move to IFRS without reconciliation creates a dilemma for organizations like ours, because our U.S. firms, our U.S. offices, don't at this point have the requisite skills and experiences in IFRS. Yet our foreign affiliates don't really have the requisite skills and PTOB standards. So that's, when you're splitting those two components, it creates concerns. Not sure that our foreign affiliated firms can directly issue, even though they may be registered, but can they issue financial statements under PCAOB standards without quite a bit of guidance from our U.S. firms. And I don't think that's currently the case. And now with the move towards IFRS without reconciliation, that could create issues for firms that are or organizations that are structured like ours.
Other panelists would like to comment?
Similar to what I mentioned in our opening remarks, in our case with regard to FPIs, somebody from our area desk would perform an IFRS expert review, which is in effect an extension of the independent review by somebody that's got more training and knowledge in IFRS, and there would be a coordination effort with our person who's performing the filing review. It's consistent with the PCOB interim standards, so-called Appendix K.
I think my response is similar to that. The Appendix K lives on, from the auditing perspective, there continues to be that involvement. It does not have to be a U.S. member firm partner involved. It could be another member firm partner, particularly from more developed countries that are knowledgeable in U.S. gas and PCAOB standards. And then I think I mentioned earlier in my remarks we do have a consultation network that deals with consulting on IFRS matters. Without regard to whether there's something lost or not. I'm not sure about that.
As we continue our discussion, I want to also bring before the advisory group two other questions we had. What quality controls can investors and other users of audit reports reasonably expect from audit firms that use their names or otherwise indicate an affiliation with PCAOB registered firms and their global audit networks? And also, should PCAOB standards incorporate best practices or other improvements to enhance quality control over audits of multinational companies? Bob Kippers?
My comment actually goes back in time to earlier part of the discussion, but it's not unrelated to these questions. Dick's example of the two sort of, I'll call them independent firms versus a networked version of those firms. This is one of those things that's a little dangerous. I'm not sure I'm right on this. But I thought that the major networks largely were members of the Forum of Firms of the International Federation of Accountants, IFAC. And I thought it was that commitment and affiliation that caused those firms to be voluntarily complying on a global basis with ISQC-1, which was a standard we referred to this morning. If that's not right, then maybe I'm off base. But I thought that was the impetus behind ISQC-1. And let me tie it together with Joe's question earlier about compensation. The same section of ISQC-1 that talks about leadership that we talked about this morning in connection with the other question also assigns the responsibility for complying firms, which would be, I think, the whole network for DTT or the others, that your performance evaluation, compensation, and promotion be tied to the commitment to quality. And so while it wouldn't be a U.S. partner, comping the partner in another member firm, I think the point is that all the firms in their own way would have to comply with that standard. I also think that with respect to a networked firm, that because their network is a member of the Forum of Firms and therefore follows the standard, you would have that tendency to get what might be argued a little bit higher commitment to quality. And then, of course, the affiliation agreement itself is yet another commitment to stay to a certain standard, and that's where the cross-firm reviews come in. So I think that that's a, hopefully a fairly simple answer to that old question.
Lynn Turner.
First, I'd like to go back to a couple of your questions, Greg. On the third one, I think the answer is yes, but it's not best practices in terms of what the firms do. But I think it should be best practices in terms of quality control in industry. And I think it goes back to what Arnie was saying. I think I'd go and I'd look at how some of the large multinationals manage quality control and draw upon that to take a look at best practices, because I personally think you're going to find much better practices there than we have in the profession, because we've grown up with this structure whereby it's just, you know, an affiliation of all these firms. It's not really a firm other than from a marketing perspective. And I think that has some serious shortcomings in that process. So I'd go back and take a look at industries like a pharmaceutical industry, where they have to maintain high quality controls worldwide, and take a look at what those do. There are some high quality international manufacturers. I'll also say that from a control point of view, I actually agree with what Greg said at the get-go, Jonas, that I think if you're really thinking about where you should move quality controls, it should be a central quality control point, which is, I think, what you're going to find in a major international organization, and it rolls down from that. And there's got to be a central point and central responsibility. And I think the question Greg asked, why not, is the right question, because I think that's where you got to turn around and migrate to. I do have some questions for the panelists, four of them really. The first one is, when you do your inspection process, I know how the firms have inspection and inspection of member firms, and you got some basic quality controls that everyone's supposed to live with, yada, 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 but a lot of the final decisions at the end of the day still rest with that local group if they decide to thumb their nose at you just because of the legal structure. But I think people try to do the right thing. But here's my question, who actually makes the selections of the actual audits to be inspected, say in a country like Japan or Australia or France? Are the selections of the audits to be inspected actually made at a central location today in London where your headquarters are, or are they made by people in those respective affiliates in those countries? First question. Second question is, we've had problems with independence on an international basis. What's the quality of your compliance today, would you say, with U.S. independence rules on the audits of U.S. registrants coming in, both U.S. registrants with foreign operations and or foreign and private issuers? Third question is, I hear you all talk about the good quality controls and how the system is working and all, and yet recently there was a report of a group of investors, institutional investors out of France, that reported that implementation of IFRS in that country has not gone very well, and that in fact they found that there's far too frequently companies have just wrapped an IFRS cover around and called the financial statements IFRS when all they're doing is still doing the statutory audit. Why is it that institutional investors are finding that with the reports being filed in France, if the quality controls are actually really working and IFRS are getting done right? Fourth and last question then is, Y'all talk about it being a seamless central operation, like, if you will, and all these common controls across. Why is it from an investor's perspective then? Because that's the way I think you'd like us to perceive you as EY International or Deloitte & Touche International. Why is it then that the first time that we see litigation pop up, you come to me and say, I don't know those other guys. Go talk to them. We're not an international company. Now all of a sudden, it's you got to go after that international affiliate because we're all separate and distinct. My four questions. Have a way. This is an exciting topic. We needed some excitement this afternoon. So.
You want one guy to take each question?
Oh, no, I'd like all four for all four questions. Bob. Thank you, but no. Shoot away, gentlemen.
Selections and inspection in individual countries. As I mentioned in my remarks, there are two models for inspection in our inspection program. One model is for the more developed, larger firms. The inspection is done by the firm itself with oversight by DTT, Global Office. In those situations, the selections of the engagements to be inspected is made within the firm, but again with oversight and challenge by the DTT Global Office. For the other member firms, the DTT inspection group in the Global Office forms teams of inspectors from other member firms. In that case, the team leader, in conjunction with the Global Office oversight, makes the engagement selections.
You know, we're relying to some extent on regulatory bodies. Once again, with the acceptance and continuance procedures that we have, we inquire of the affiliated firm's internal inspections, of their regulatory body inspections, and the results of those inspections as well. So, you know, that's how we move forward with working with our affiliates. Independence issues, our clients are scalable. You know, they generally work with one or two other offices around the world. They're not, so to speak, multinational, as that word might commonly be, you know, be tossed around, in terms of not in 40 or 50 countries generally. So if they were, we probably wouldn't get past the acceptance process. With respect to questions, excuse me?
Tenants rules, good compliance today then?
Yes, I think okay. So, because it's done on an individual office-by-office basis. With respect to the IFRS issue, I guess I'm to somewhat extent pleased to hear that it's not only us having difficulties with IFRS. Other countries are having IFRS problems as well. So France, I guess, has been doing it for several years now. And the one firm issue, I think that's, you know, it's really not for me to say, but you know, I think that is a concern, or a question. What do investors expect? So, I guess that'll play itself out over time.
With respect to the inspection process, Lynn, we make all the selections at the global level. There's no involvement from the member firm in the selection. And I think, as was commented earlier, that, you know, there's a number of factors that go into that. We have a sufficiently, you know, a relatively small number of foreign private issuers in our network, so that tends to be a key factor when looking at the selection internationally in those firms. And then if you've had issues on engagements in the past, in prior selections, they'll tend to be looked at again. The independence compliance question, we have raised the bar internally with regard to our own policies in this respect, and are in the process of deploying our tracking system globally as we speak. So, you know, I think that raised focus on the topic, we've um, We've got a lot of firms now running around with greater awareness of things that I suspect if you'd looked at them before we'd introduced those policies, they wouldn't have had the same level of awareness. So I'm more comfortable today with that level of compliance than I would have been a couple of years ago.
Would you say your compliance is good today then?
Well, you know, the SEC had this voluntary self-inspection review program that was recently completed by the larger networks. In fact, I'm meeting with them next week to go through and discuss the process that we followed, but the results actually were very good. I mean, that's a subjective statement, but I think given the number of filers that we have, the number of firms involved, particularly when you consider that for a number of those foreign member firms, they only had a handful of SEC registrants, so they lacked the institutional knowledge that you would expect a firm like the U.S. to have. I think the results were pretty good. I can't really comment on the French Institutional Investors report. I'm not familiar with that report. I mean, I do know that our network has only a very, very small number today of FPIs that are filing an IFRS. In fact, as far as I'm aware, we only have one. So it's a little bit early for me to really comment and see to what extent that's becoming an issue, at least with respect to SEC filers. Your last question is a tough one. I think the reality is, this is no surprise to you, I know you're an expert on the subject, but the issue is really one of self-survival. While there's a desire across the network and the member firms and a shared interest in wanting to have an appropriate quality control process in place and a lot of the common standards and procedures that we've been talking about for the last hour or so, there's also a recognition, and I think the litigation environment drives, frankly, a lot of the thinking today in the profession with regard to the international structures. I think it creates impediments in the profession that create a barrier, frankly, for the international networks to fully replicate what you were referring to in terms of what the corporates do. It's a challenge. There are those who would argue that if you want to present yourself as a seamless international global organization, then you ought to put in place the control mechanisms that fully reflect that and live with the consequences. But if you want a profession that's going to operate in the free market, then I think you can only expect the owners of the member firms to act in a rational way, and for the owners of those firms to create a single global firm, for example, I would argue isn't rational in the current litigation environment.
Yeah. With regard to the inspection process for the FPIs, those selections are made centrally by our global internal inspection group and with input from appropriate parties if there are others that need to be inspected. For example, I might provide some input that I'd like to see a couple engagements inspected.
Let me ask you a question when you say FPIs, but what about, let's say, on a Coca-Cola, which has operations are around the globe and most of the operations are outside the United States. So part of those operations might be audited in China or might be audited in Australia. Who makes the selections of examinations of those audits outside and the actual review of the audit outside the U.S.?
With regard to the subsidiary audits of domestic registrants. First of all, there's a selection made in the U.S., which may include some subsidiaries, and then there's a globally coordinated program. So, regarding the independence rules, as I know you're aware, at least anecdotally, we've all invested a lot of time, effort, and money, and I think at least our firm, we feel like we've made substantial progress with regard to independence. The IFRS question is, you know, seemingly the easiest, but maybe one of the most complicated, because there are a number of factors that impact IFRS implementation. And I think it's a huge issue for all of us sitting here at this table that are participants. And here's why. You know, by having IFRS out there and everybody adopting it as their national GAAP, I think the you know, the investing public looks at it and says, oh, it should be absolutely the same every single place in the world. But if you look at all the other various components in the system, there is not they're not all unified. For example, you know, the various markets are all regulated by country regulators around the world. And they've done an excellent job of working together with regard to promoting consistency, this and that, but, you know, it's still not a single system as well. And, you know, we face the same thing internally. I described earlier what we're trying to do to get consistent IFRS answers around the world. It's also complicated by the fact, and I didn't fully appreciate this till I did my first review of somebody that was implementing IFRS about 3 years ago, and I remember the reconciliation footnote was like more than 30 pages. You know, it was unbelievable. I was surprised by that in the first place, that, you know, it would take that much to describe it, which I found surprising. Second of all, if you really study IFRS 1, there are a number of places where you can elect prior balances and or fair value as the starting point before you implement IFRS. And, you know, that has a short-term impact on what we're going to see in those financial statements. I'm not familiar with the French report. I would be delighted to read it. I would find it helpful and interesting.
So you don't have any idea why we're getting that type of implementation in France?
Well, I think I just described, you know, a number of factors that face IFRS. I'm not familiar with the report and can't respond specifically.
How about the last question about marketing as an entire company, but when something gets in, or company, but when something gets in trouble, you don't know those guys?
Well, I look forward to talking to you offline afterwards to figure out how to run away.
Guy, there were a couple there for you.
Yeah, I didn't realize we were going to do them all at once like that. The independent side, I echo what Jack said. We've certainly spent a lot of resources, and both in terms of time and people and dollars to up the game since the late 90s, early 2000s, and my belief is that that things are significantly different than they were then on the better side.
Good compliance today.
Lynn, I'd say good compliance, depending on. You may not say that same compliance is good, so I would say good compliance, particularly given the, you know, the number of entities involved and the number of ways that one can now slip up and violate independence rules, all the way from things that are fairly inconsequential to obviously some that are important. I would say overall good compliance. I'm really not in a position to talk about IFRS and what happened in France. I hadn't seen the report, and even if I did, I'm not sure I'd be able to comment on it. Litigation, I agree with Jack. After you talk with him offline, I'll... Although I will say Paul gave a not for a pun here, but he gave a rational explanation, I think, of some of the considerations that do go on. I mean, and I would say, you know, from just kind of a related comment, I would hope that the members of the group that maybe were not as familiar with the international organizations that we have in place before today do now have a feel for it's more than a marketing ploy or something, that we really have, and much the same way as independence globally, I think the international organization over the last several years, since the late 90s, early 2000s, have put a lot of time and energy and resources into making the quality control processes better. Otherwise, we wouldn't try to have common policies. We wouldn't spend the money on, you know, common inspection programs and common technology and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, if there's a problem with the U.S. registrant from a litigation standpoint, you have the U.S. firm standing behind the report that it issued and is held responsible, for a problem in a small member firm speaking as a U.S. partner now, that the U.S. firm had nothing to do with, and didn't touch, wasn't consulted, nothing involved. I think Paul's observations about rationality make a lot of sense.
Let me just interrupt for a moment. Just a note that we didn't receive any recommendations for emerging issues at this meeting, so we do have a little extra time, so I think we can continue with this subject, even though the time is up, with the people who have indicated that they'd like to comment or ask questions. Go ahead.
Liz Fender.
Thank you. Jack started to address a topic of concern that I had after reading these papers. The questions I have are about the SEC did this review of filings and made a distinction between jurisdictional IFRS and IFRS as published by the IFRS. And I guess my question for panelists, it's related to the inconsistent application of IFRS as well, but the first question might be is that information publicly clear to investors that you've made an opinion on jurisdictional IFRS versus IFRS? It seems like the SEC was able to figure that out, but I'm not sure where I would find that information, or if it's just a blank, or it's just part of a standard audit opinion on IFRS without any description.
You guys want me to take this? I'm having a good time. Now, with regard to whether or not one follows IFRS as issued by the ISB, or IFRS is endorsed by another country, the SEC did make a distinction and said that, in fact, in order to avail yourself of the accommodation not to reconcile to U.S. GAAP, that you had to clearly state, unexplicitly and unreservedly, that it is IFRS as issued by the ISB, and so you should look to the basis of presentation footnote, which is generally going to be the in the first footnote of the financial statements. And in addition to that, the auditors are required to opine on IFRS as issued by the ISB, so you can look to the auditor's financial statement opinion with regard to this issue. I think there's a handful of people that have filed at this point, and to the best of my knowledge, they've all stated that. There is an accommodation that, to the best of my knowledge, impacts about six people that you can do IFRS as endorsed by the EU, if the only difference is with regard to the special temporary carve-out
provision that's a temporary accommodation, and you're required to reconcile the current year to IFRS as issued by the ISB to illustrate the difference.
Could I just follow up for a second? So that means in the future it will be clear. It hasn't been clear in the past, but it must be now that the new reconciliation requirements are in place?
Well, I'm not sure that I would choose the same words that you just chose to say that it wasn't clear. And you know, after we get all done laughing, I'll try to provide a plausible explanation for this.
We're all interested.
The SEC rules allowed for IFRS as issued by or as endorsed by the EU to be a comprehensive basis of accounting that one could reconcile to U.S. GAAP in the past. And because of the fact that most European companies, and that's where most of the IFRS implementation has occurred at this point, they are locally required to follow IFRS as endorsed by the EU and make the statement that they do that, that's why they chose that boundary gap. Now, in order to avail themselves of a prior accommodation, there couldn't be any reconciling difference where they had to do some sort of reconciliation process to only do 2 years the first year. So, pardon me if I'm getting a little technical, but you're asking me technical questions.
Barbara Roper.
I'd like to actually go back to the first question that you all posted. Because the more I looked at it, the more it struck me that the SEC has, in its wisdom, dumped a huge mess in your lap. In a system where we're using IFRS, which by its nature allows considerable variability of application, and which, as the study Lynn referred to, the French Institutional Investor study found, one of their findings was that there is still considerable local variability in IFRS, something they refer to, for example, as nostalgia for the old standards, in which we have very different regulatory standards in countries and structures in countries across the globe, and in which we have very different compliance cultures around the globe. And in that environment, the SEC, in its wisdom, removed the requirement that these foreign issuers listing here reconcile to GAAP. The one single factor which seemed to provide some kind of discipline in the system, not to mention the best incentive we have for further convergence between U.S. GAAP and IFRS. And now you're asking the question, is there something we can do through quality controls that gets this genie back in the bottle and that creates some kind of incentive for uniformity? And, you know, I don't know. I sure hope so. But I have to say I look at that with some skepticism, and if the SEC goes ahead with its plans on mutual recognition, I think that question gets even bigger and the lack of uniformity gets even more serious. And I just think it's a very disturbing direction that they're headed, and I sympathize with you as you look to see whether there's a route out of this mess.
I'd like to go back to a few of Lynn's comments before he asked his four questions, and in case he left this group with the wrong impression, I'd like to correct it for him. Paint a slightly different picture. Lynn, when you described what a global network looked like today and just kind of loose affiliation of firms and some other things I won't go into. I guess I would speak for only one firm, but I don't think that's the way we look today. I think we've made great efforts to strengthen our global center. We're not to the point where we are a U.S. parent with 140 100% owned subs, so we still can't quite get maybe to the way an MNC is organized. But I guess I would just leave this group with, we've come a long way in trying to make that global center much more effective. We're further along the curve, I think, than those comments really give us credit for, and we still have to work it out for us, but we are committed to doing that, and I hope that the comments of this panel come across that same way.
This is Damon. Can I get in at some point?
Yes, Damon, go ahead.
I think that this discussion does show that certainly the firms that are present here today are you know, working on building their global networks and dealing with some of the complex issues presented by, you know, economic globalization. However, I think that somewhere in this mix is, you know, what should the PCAOB, how should this affect the PCAOB's carrying out of its mission? And the only comment I would make about that is this, that, you know, the fundamental purpose of the PCAOB is to be an outside regulator of the firms that audit public companies that are listed in the U.S. markets. And that that means, you know, some level of oversight over foreign firms that play roles in that process, whether they sign the financial statements, whether they sign the audit letter in the case of foreign private issuers, or whether they are contributing in some fashion to what is ultimately a work product signed off on by the U.S. firm. And that the PCAOB, I think, needs to be mindful here not to let self-regulation, you know, sort of in by the back door. That's not the mandate. And while you all have lots of ability to tap both the strengths of these developing networks and the internal standards that they're trying to develop, and obviously to work with your foreign counterpart agencies, at the end of the day, at least insofar as companies that are listed on U.S. markets, the buck stops with you, the PCAOB.
Thank you, Damon. Mark Olson?
I've been listening to this from a couple of perspectives, and I think Damon gives me an opportunity to just reflect on a few thoughts. And your starting point, Damon, is exactly right. And that the mandate that we have is to look at the manner in which audits are conducted of companies that are listed on U.S. firms through the prism of the auditing firm. And that gives us an ability, I think, to establish a standard and hold firms to that standard. And the extent to which we rely on our counterparts around the world will, to a great extent, depend on the extent to which we're comfortable with their level of capability. But the reason we are in that circumstance is because the U.S. is a very attractive market, and markets are global, and we expect that firms outside the U.S. will be attracted to the U.S. and the U.S. capital markets. I suspect that the growth pattern of most accounting firms is exactly the reverse of that. That the reason they're global is because their customer base is global. And so if you start from the fact that the customer base is global, then you ask the question in a slightly different way. Do you enhance consumer protection by somehow balkanizing the profession or the regulatory structure of the profession or the environment that you function in, or do you look for ways that you can, in the most practical and efficient and effective way, harmonize those efforts? And there's an extent to which they are there in conflict, because it is relatively, the more complexity you add to it, the greater the difficulty is for all of us. And I think ours is probably, Damon, the easiest, because of the fact that we have a very specific mandate, and we can ask people to meet that mandate in a way that meets our specifications.
But I think we need to do that in the context of being aware of the of all of the other global implications of the economy. You don't design an economy to fit the regulatory structure. You design the regulatory structure to fit the economy. And at least that's my take on it. So we're very conscious of I think what you just. What you just outlined, and to me, this is a very important subject, and I know it won't end with the discussion that we have here.
Cynthia Richardson.
I just have two quick comments. Actually, one's kind of a question. I'd like to just go back to the, sort of the comments the panel was alluding to about litigation and this litigation environment we're in. And I think I heard, and if I'm wrong, correct me, but that you can't truly be have the quality controls of a multinational corporation like a Coca-Cola or some such organization due to this litigation environment, and you'd need some kind of liability protections. Well, the last time I checked, I mean, if I'm wrong, correct me, but the multinational companies don't have liability caps, and they seem to be doing just fine. So I'm a little confused. And about this reference to the litigation environment, the last time I looked at any of the research done by Stanford, Cornerstone Research, et cetera, but for the subprime uptick in fraud and litigation, the numbers have been declining significantly. And I think last time I looked at audit firm lawsuits, specifically class actions, I think there were five or fewer filed. So I'm always concerned about how these things are being characterized. My other comment is, if we're going to look at quality control standards, I think that to the extent, and again, if I'm wrong, correct me, but I understand that the large firms are signing the audit reports, for example, KPMG US or KPMG International. And at least when it says KPMG US, you know that some audit firm in the United States of America did the work on the audit. But when it's signed KPMG International, you have no idea if it's a China affiliate, a Brazil affiliate, whomever. So I guess for transparency purposes, if for no other reason, that if there's a quality control standard adopted by PCAOB, there ought to be more specificity in, quote, the signing of the audit report by the firm that actually did the work. Thank you.
Sam Renzo.
I don't think I was next in line, but I think I was the next one picked on. If there is an auditor's report signed KPMG International, I would like to see it, because that organization has no employees. If you're referring to KPMG International as something other than KPMG LLP US, then I understand your question.
So how do you sign, what are the signature blocks that you use on audit reports, U.S. versus non-U.S.? Because there's more people than me that have heard what I just said.
U.S. Like the fact. KPMG LLP. That's the legal name of the organization. Now, there's 130 organizations outside the U.S. They would sign those by their legal name.
It could be just KPMG, and then it would have an address as to where it came from.
Those reports also indicate the location where the report was signed as well.
Right. There's specific SEC requirements that state that you use the legal name as well as the location of the office in which the report was signed.
Thank you.
Lynn Turner.
Mark, I know you guys have been doing joint inspections with the some of the foreign regulators, and I think that has worked pretty good, and I just encourage you to keep those up. I think gives you the best of someone in home country and from the registrant's country, and I think having that knowledge base is something that you ought to seriously look at. Consider continue to do. I see no reason to move away, quite frankly, today from that joint inspection type program, and it keeps both teams sharp and on their toes. And when we have things like 404 here that they may not have over there, it makes it very difficult to have inspections that are meaningful over there if you don't have members of the team from here. So I agree with you on that. Randy, I'd like to think that you are one seamless firm, and I think certainly from some of my experience that has been true, but yet when I come back and I see what's in the French report, or I see IOSCO coming out here in the last couple of weeks, and IOSCO actually writing something saying, you got to start putting this in your reports. That is, you got to start putting in your reports that you're not using ISP by ISP. They don't put, IOSCO doesn't come out with something like that if it's already occurring. So they clearly saw a significant shortfall in the auditing reports by the firms. And it would be a lot better if the firms took care of that problem than IOSCO having to come out. I mean, that shouldn't have ever happened. It just goes, it's just one more thing that says, until a regulator is there telling you you got to do it, it ain't going to happen. Everyone knew that was the right answer. And when you see that and you hear about the joint quality control, you see what happened in Japan with one firm, it just, I think it really does get back to what Jonas started off with, and that is, I think it needs to be seamless, one centrally coordinated outfit that controls the whole quality control process, bar none, and eliminate some of these things that cause investors, not only here, but places like France, one of the largest economies in Europe, to turn around and question whether or not you can rely upon those reports or whether or not you're getting all the facts. So I think the sooner we get to that type of situation, then with strong joint cooperation amongst all the inspectors, I think that is good. Until we get there, though, I think it's important that we keep Appendix K. Appendix K was put in because we had registrants coming into this country, and there wasn't a check. We had auditors from outside this country that didn't know U.S. auditing standards, and we've heard a little of that already today. We've seen that people haven't been able to get IFRS right in a country that should have been able to get it right the very first time, France. We've got the investors telling us we still get a nostalgia gap. And until we get those things corrected, the only way we're going to make sure that investors in the U.S. are protected is if we got someone in the national offices of each of the firms doing those reviews to make sure that they're okay. When we didn't have that before, we had some absolutely atrocious financial statements going through the filings here, and that cost the SEC a lot of time and exposed investors to risk. So I think until these things get ironed out and put in place, I think Appendix K is absolutely needed.
Great. If I can just make one comment from a panel perspective or from my own perspective with regard to Lynn's comments, I don't know why IOSCO put out this statement. IFRS is issued by the ISP. But with regard to whether or not one was required to use IFRS as issued by ISP or a jurisdictional version, that prior to this recent accommodation, there wasn't any reason to compel people to use IFRS as issued by the ISP. In fact, they were more compelled, say, a European country to use IFRS as endorsed by the EU. So that way they could satisfy on a simultaneous basis both regulatory requirements. I do recall the fact that, you know, if you look at the international outline, you're to be explicit with regard to your basis of presentation, and that this was an issue covered at the SEC conference a couple of years ago when IFRS was initially implemented and the staff initially went through and looked at the implementation. So just food for thought.
Giovanna Palmrose.
Thank you. I just wanted to correct an inaccurate perception that Cynthia Richardson just expressed, and it's one to do with the frequency of litigation involving auditor defendants, in particular the frequency of securities class action litigation. I think the statistic that you just quoted came from the Stanford Securities Class Action Clearinghouse and Cornerstone database. And a few weeks ago in testimony for the Treasury Advisory Committee, an open meeting in Los Angeles, Joe Grundfest apologized for contributing to these inaccurate perceptions. He said their database does not track auditor litigation accurately. The only thing it has is the count when the auditor is named in the initial complaint that's filed. And typically auditors are attached later, and so they don't continue to track that. So he actually said that they may have some kind of, they're considering putting some kind of disclaimer or making it known that that is not an accurate way to come up with a frequency of litigation involving auditor defendants on securities class actions. It understates it. Thank you for that.
Can I get in here a moment?
Yes, Damon, go ahead.
This is one of the most frustrating things about, I think, policy work in the area of auditing right now, is the lack of reliable data on the litigation environment. I think Zavala certainly accurately characterized what Joe said at that hearing. On the other hand, the data that was presented by the audit firms at that hearing conflated lawsuits filed, class action lawsuits filed in the federal security system, with lawsuits filed by clients against audit firms. Not class actions, but suits filed by issuers. In addition to that, suits filed in the various state systems and various other kinds of duty claims. I don't think anybody really knows right now what the truth is. I do know what the totality of litigation brought against audit firms is, at least according to the industry in their submission to the hearing Savannah was referring to. It's significant, but again, you can't figure out what the real sources of it are. And it's hard to imagine a world in which we would be telling companies that they couldn't, they would have no cause of action against their auditor. But in any case, I just think that the data problems here are not limited to the problem Joe pointed out, but just to the unwillingness, I think, frankly, of either plaintiff's lawyers or audit firms to be candid about what, in fact, is actually going on. I don't really know.
Okay, we have three more tent cards up, so we'll start in the order in the back and move forward. We'll start with Joe Carcel, and then we'll wrap up with two more after that.
I'll make it quick, Greg. Lynn and Damon and Mark Olson all refer to, in some sense, without mentioning it by name, Rule 4012, proposed Rule 4012. And frankly, I was a bit surprised that that wasn't on the agenda today. I think that's a major issue. And for what it's worth, I would suggest to the board that it's something we may want to talk about in June. You'll have the comments by then. And unless there's a final rule issued, it might be worth talking about in June. The second issue is, given the movement toward adoption of international accounting standards, it's hard to imagine that there won't be a discussion of a movement toward international auditing standards and the role of the IAASB vis-a-vis the role of the PCAOB. I think that's a major issue that should be discussed by this group.
Lynn Turner.
I'd just like to echo what Joe just said about the mutual recognition proposal. I think it's a very good topic for this group to chew into, and I think it would be a very good one to have at the next go-around. With respect to Joe Grunfest's testimony out in L.A., Zobana is right. Joe did mention that he just picks up the initial filings and not subsequent filings. But Zobana and others have testified to us at the Treasury as well, though, that the cases against the auditors have dropped dramatically off, notwithstanding what's in the Stanford case.
Bob Kippers.
Just a couple things. With respect to Cindy's point about the corporate community not needing or having liability caps or anything of the sort, obviously huge difference between corporates that can use shareholders' money to settle litigation and the 15 of us around the table or so who have not only their capital at risk but their retirement and everything that goes with it in terms of personal assets. It's a very different model, obviously. On Damon's point, I mean, I don't know, but hundreds of millions of dollars later, it feels to me like suits against the firm by clients are just as expensive as the ones that come from other people, so I don't know why that's not germane. I think that if we have the same conversation 6 months from now, we'll find that any tail off in litigation was short-lived.
Thank you, Bob, and I want to thank our panelists for spending the afternoon with us. Thank you very much.
I, too, want to thank the panelists and the SAG, and I'm not even going to attempt to summarize this meeting. We covered a lot of ground. I think everybody can travel home feeling very comforted that you've put in a full day's work. Thank you very much. Travel safely. Our next meeting is scheduled for June 25 and 26. Here in Washington. As we get closer to that date, we will confirm whether it will be 2 days and what the specific timing will be. Thank you again, and the meeting is adjourned.